This week on Making Contact.
We are killing the planet. It is absolutely unsustainable the way we're living.
We have to educate the people and start doing something from now on before it's too late.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we profile two activists taking on the global water crisis. Canadian Maud Barlow is a well-known leader in the global struggle for water justice. And Guiyun of China is in the vanguard of her country's growing conservation movement. Both Maud Barlow and Guiyun warn us about the link between climate change, global warming, and the loss of one of our most basic human requirements, water for life. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact. This program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series. As Dar Williams sings, people often do take water for granted. But where would we be and what could we do without our rivers, our seas, and our oceans? Worldwide, the supply of fresh water is shrinking at alarming rates. Some of the largest rivers in the world no longer flow to the seas. Most of the world's people have to travel long distances in search of water for survival. Others are caught in floods, glacier melts, fire, and extreme weather. Agriculture, industry, and manufacturing pollute vast waterways, with hundreds of thousands of tons of pesticides per year coming from the European Union alone. And global profiteers exploit water problems in a $400 billion industry, the world's third largest, behind oil and electricity. Maud Barlow, founder of the Blue Planet Project, head of the Council of Canadians, author of many books, including her newest, titled Blue Covenant, argues that the global water crisis is driving climate change and global warming.
We all learned in grade six that doesn't matter what you do to water, it just goes round and round and round in the cycle. Not true. Our teachers weren't lying, but it's not true. And this is so important. I so strongly want to say this. We have actually impacted the climate and interrupted the hydrologic cycle by our pollution mismanagement, abuse, and displacement of water, taking it from where it's needed for a healthy hydrologic cycle to where we want it to be, and then we destroy it. When you pave over and you destroy what's called water retentive landscapes, remove the vegetation, when you remove the trees and when you remove the wetlands and when you remove the meadows and the green spaces, what happens is that the rain can't fall in the way that we thought it could, because it needs to fall on something green, which takes it in, and then it's transpired. It's called transpiration. It's transpired out, and that's how it gets back into the cycle. And we are creating massive deserts around the world. China alone, they're creating a desert the size of Rhode Island every single year. So this means that we're drying up the earth from below, and we keep hearing about the impact of climate change on water, and there is, of course, with the melting glaciers and so on, but we are also affecting climate change with our abuse of water, and we really need to put that analysis into the mix. So the place we have to start is with source protection. We have to protect the source of water around the world. We have to stop polluting the water that the earth gave us, that nature gave us, that we all depend on for life. If we don't stop doing that, it's like pumping poison into your blood and wondering why you're getting sick. A number of things have to be done. First of all, we have to deeply question, I don't even start with water, we have to deeply question the whole concept of economic globalization, market-based capitalism, head-to-head competition, export-driven economics, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and the whole monstrous ball of wax. We have to take the whole thing and say that it is killing the earth, that it is absolutely unsustainable. In Blue Covenant, I have a chapter on how the World Bank manufactured consent in the Global South for a private water system. And it is a new form of colonialism, and it's as virulent as slavery, in my opinion. It is as virulent and awful for our countries, and I include my own country of Canada, to promote these policies that treat the third world this way. And there is not going to be any answer to the global water crisis until we address the inequities that exist.
In 2005, Maud Barlow won the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Prize, for raising awareness about the need for better stewardship of the world's water sources. She used the proceeds of the prestigious award to show how even small investments can provide access to clean water and save lives.
I have a very special place in my heart for Bolivia, which is one of the poorest countries in Latin America, because it was a first water war there in a place called Cochabamba when the World Bank forced Bolivia Cochabamba to accept a private company, and they brought in Bechtel. And Bechtel not only tripled the price of water, but they said to people, we own the water you collect in the cisterns on your roofs. And the people said, no, you don't. And they said, yes, we do. And there was a civil war, and the army was brought in, and a young kid was killed. It was a terrible thing, and the people won. Then they brought privatization into El Alto and La Paz, the capital, and it's another horrible story, another horrible struggle ensued, and so on. So I've spent a great deal of time there working with wonderful people, particularly in an indigenous community called Solidaridad in the hills in El Alto overlooking La Paz. And the first time I was there, I wept for days. I don't cry easily. With some money from the World Bank, they'd sort of half built this little half village where the houses were half built and then the money ran out. There was no electricity, no running water, no heat. They had a little hospital somebody built, a little health center, no water, no electricity, no heat. So it was just sitting there. A school, no water, no electricity, no heat, no teachers. And women in particular loved me, just held me and hugged me. And, you know, when we left, the kids were crying. And I just remember going down that mountain and just feeling devastated that I was leaving these women and kids behind who were just living this way. So I got committed to this particular place. And when I won the Right Livelihood Award a couple of years ago and I got a little bit of money, I spent it, most of it, hooking this particular community up to the grid in terms of water. And when I went back the next time, there were six water taps. As really a funny story at one level, because Suez is the company that was running the water system that they had to buy into. And when we got the pipes built, Suez came with a bunch of their entourage and the media to take ownership for this, that suddenly water was being brought into this community and the women chased them out with their brooms. I just love this story. They literally chased the boat, get on your bus and get the hell out of here. It was the women who did it. When I came to visit the next time, one of the women came up and she just took my hand and she said, since this water's come in, no children have died. And it's been a long time that we go through, even a couple of months, that the baby doesn't die. And if you die of dirty water, it's a really awful death. So there are wonderful stories like that involving women that touch me deeply. I come out of the women's movement, and all the work that I do now is informed by that early work that I did. So my passion and all my instruction and all my early training was about women's equality. So for the work that I do now, the connection might seem tenuous, but for me, it's not at all. It's all about equality. It's all about a feminist vision, actually, of the environment and how we live our lives. And for instance, in the water issue that I deal with so much, women are the ones who, in all of the Global South, go find the water, are responsible for caring for families, for health care, for providing food, for the small gardens. If they don't find water, the family doesn't have water. If you have to wait 2-3 hours or walk 2-3 hours a day and wait for water, you're not going to school, you're not working, you're not doing the other things that you might want to do as a person. And so bringing water into a community and bringing public accessible clean water means the girls can go to school. It's very much a women's issue. And I'm so glad I had that early training in the women's movement because it's just informed everything I've done and the way that I approach my work, which is that I think that you need to be there as a support to people, not some kind of leader coming from above, but really, truly there in solidarity.
Maud Barlow is well known as a worldwide force to be reckoned with on issues of water justice. She's had to face and face down the wrath of many an adversary. She learned lessons in equanimity from her mother.
Oh, yeah, I have been threatened with lawsuits, and I've certainly, it seems to have passed now, but for a long time I had trouble getting into the United States at the border. Whatever was in my file, I would get stopped and questioned, sometimes taken into a different room and more questions and so on. I am deeply disliked within the big corporate community, particularly the water community and the World Bank. I remember in Kyoto, Japan, at a big conference put on by this World Water Forum a couple of years ago, I was walking with a Japanese journalist, and he said, "My God, they're scared of you." I said, "Who?" He said, "All of them, the suits, you know." He said, "You even say the word Canada." And they just go, "Isn't that where that woman's from? You know, it must be a terrible place because she's from there, you know." And I remember it hit really hard when I was publicly criticized in a national newspaper, the Globe and Mail in Canada. And I was at my mom's house one day, and I was kind of feeling sorry for myself. And she said, this is the traditional homemaker, "You cut that out," she said. She said, "Serious people have serious enemies. And if you're going to speak your mind, this is what's going to happen, and you should be proud of it." And I've never forgotten it. It's a lesson I give to young women when I speak to them, that you can't, yes, you want to be loved, but choose the people who love you. You're not going to be loved by everybody. And I also learned very early on not to hate anybody. I actually don't think I hate anybody in the world. I really don't. I think hate makes you sick. And I don't have time for it. It's none of this is personal. I never make it personal. I'm never rude to people I debate. Again, my mother, my brilliant mother. Again, when I would be on television debating people, and they'd turn and then you get the side of their face, right? And they'd be back and forth. My mother said, "Always remember, you're speaking to me through that television, one person at a time. And I want to hear you pleasant and polite and respectful and putting a clear message. And if you can only speak half as much time as your opponent, but your opponent's yelling and being unreasonable, you're the one I hear."
In the race to solve the Earth's water problems, Maud Barlow is one of the leaders of the water justice movement who reject large-scale desalination plants as a high-tech quick fix that will worsen problems in the long run.
First of all, they're huge and they're ugly and they're energy intensive. They use an enormous amount of fossil fuel. So now they're talking about fueling them by nuclear power, which is going to provide a whole new set of problems, okay, number one. Number two, they're polluting. What happens is these big machines take in all this salt water, but all this aquatic life as well, all the organisms and even fish and so on, which all get killed. Then they take the fresh salt water out with a chemical through reverse osmosis, and then what they put back into the ocean is a combination of the chemical, the dead aquatic life, and the thick, thick salt brine. And it kills everything within miles. Then I worry about what it's going to do to the ocean if we take out a lot of fresh water, and where oceans are already acidifying. This is one of the next big issues that have been identified by the international science community working with the UN on climate change, is the acidification of the ocean. My connecting worry is the trust and reliance being put on high technology as the answer to our water problems here in the United States in particular, but to some extent in Europe and China too. And that is, instead of conservation and source protection, the government here and the Pentagon, the State Department, are putting huge amounts of money into research on high technology solutions, which just coincidentally happen to make some big American corporations really, 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 really rich. So these companies like General Electric, Dow Chemical, these companies are becoming great big new superpower water companies, and they're cleaning up water, selling it back to us at exorbitant rates. And you're going to see the price of water rise exponentially. I met with the senior water manager for the Los Angeles Water Authority, and he said, "We don't have to go to desalination. If we conserved water here, we could find," he didn't say save, he said we could find water if we moved to conservation, but people won't give up their lawns and their swimming pools and their golf courses. You know, I don't have any miracle answers here. We all collectively have to come to the ways that we are going to decide to change our lifestyles to save water. And there are myriad wonderful projects and ideas out there. And it's part of, I think, the next wave of the concern around water is to collect all of this information, these best practices, and really put that out to the world. Very exciting possibilities. But individual water use around the world only accounts for about 10% of the water abuse. Most of it is either corporate farming or industrial production, bad industrial production. And unless we deal with those realities, unless we change our agricultural processes, our food growing processes to be more sustainable, to stop using chemical pollutants, to stop this intensive livestock operations, which then create these huge vats of poisoned water, until we stop pulling up oil with ancient pure water that's then destroyed, until we stop behaving like that around water, our individual actions will matter, but they won't matter enough. And that's why we need the rule of law. We need our governments to take action. I believe the day will come when everything we do is measured against its impact on water. We'll understand it that way, or we'll die. We'll be one of the species in this sixth extinction that goes. And, you know, it's a lesson we just have no choice but to learn.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Today's program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org. Environmental activist Ge Yun was born in the province of Jiangsu near the city of Shanghai only 34 years ago. In her young life, Ge Yun has seen a transformation in China that both saddens her and inspires her life's work.
When I was still a child, I remembered very clearly how clean our rivers and lakes were and how beautiful the butterflies flying in the air, blue and yellow and white. But all these things have gone and disappeared from our life. Personally, I'm very in favor of those poets living in ancient times of China, because from their writings and their poems, I can imagine vividly a nice scenery and beautiful scenery of China in the past. I can only trace these tracks from the poems. And I wish Chinese and probably our generation can still live in a beautiful landscape. In early 1990s, there was domestic environmental NGOs which organized programs to provide environmental education for younger students in poor regions. And I got myself enrolled in and became a volunteer. And that experience in the very remote and poor mountain areas really had great impact on me. I think it's of great significance to educate the kids when the rapid industrialization, before everything is too late, we can still do something to influence the next generation to keep some of the clean land in China. Because kids are very active, they are very enthusiastic, they want to learn new things. So it's very easy to bring those green and environmental seeds in their small hearts, which really impressed me.
In recognition of Ge Yun's commitment to environmental activism, the Xinjiang Conservation Fund chose her to become their first executive director and only full-time staff. The fund was established to protect the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region in northwest China. In just 2 short years, Guiyan added 6 staff members and began many new projects, including a wide-reaching project on water conservation issues.
Each Chinese knows quite much about Xinjiang because we learn this from our geographic textbook when we are in the schools. And for me, it's really a mysterious and exotic region. Xinjiang is a place composed of 3 big range of mountains, and in between, there are 2 big deserts. So most of the people in Xinjiang are living in oases, and the relationship between human beings and the natural environment is really fragile and very sensitive. Most of the people in Xinjiang really rely on groundwater and water from the mountains. But ironically, the efficiency of water usage in Xinjiang is worse than other parts of China. They are wasting the very valuable water resources. First, for example, the very outdated irrigation system. And secondly, the water usage in urban cities. Citizens don't care about the water running from the tap. They think it will never stop. And also those industries moving now little by little from the very developed eastern regions to the western China, they are also demanding more water. And we want to help the local people to understand thoroughly what kind of water pollution those factories might cause and what kind of negative impact on human and public health. So we started from an education program. We made a wetland map of Xinjiang, which we marked all the major rivers and lakes in Xinjiang. We try to raise the public awareness of how important these rivers and lakes are. And we also point out in this map the challenges which are facing the rivers and lakes. For example, over-exploitation and the acidification, construction of dams. And another important part of this project is to help some township people which live close to the Urumqi River, but their water resources and air condition has been greatly impacted by some polluting factories near the river. According to some citizens, they told us the water from the river is no longer drinkable, so they have to go several miles in the day to carry drinkable water from another place. I think every human being has the right to have access to safe drinkable water. It's part of undeniable human rights. How to tackle this problem? I think there are several perspectives and approaches. I think first of all, we have to really balance the rapid economic growth and the sustainable development. GDP growth rate is not number one thing or not the only thing. We have to combine or include what would be the impact of this GDP rate on our natural environment. Last year, SEPA, currently a Ministry of Environmental Protection of China, has been actively to introduce more financial leverage to encourage factories to behave more environmental friendly. For example, if the factory can achieve wastewater free, then the Ministry of Environmental Protection and other financial institutions, for example, commercial banks of China or other financiers, can provide more loans to this environmental friendly company. And in contrast, we can use more financial leverage to punish or give lessons to those factories which do not abide by our environmental laws and regulations. For example, not giving them loans or not approve IPO in the stock exchange market. Green financial leverage is a very new concept in China. Ministry of Environmental Protection of China just started the practice last year to put a list on which those polluting companies will be, and then the financial commercial banks won't give loans to those companies in the blacklist accordingly. But so far, in the national level, we have only 30 companies on this blacklist. So we have lots of things to do, and it won't be an easy process. And I think it's very necessary to encourage public participation and participation of NGOs and civil society in policy making. We have to have people's voice heard in policy making to make sure their rights, their environmental rights, are not threatened or damaged by those relatively more powerful industries in China. I think this is very important. And certainly, personally, I'm very much against the upcoming privatization of water sector in many developing countries, including China, including Xinjiang, because water is a public good. It's very different from other commodities in a sense. And it cannot be privatized or purchased by any of the multinationals. Sooner or later, to get the profits, the multinationals will necessarily increase the water rates. And consequently, it is the people who have to suffer, particularly for those poorer families. It will become a huge burden to even pay for the water rates in their daily life.
Guiyan is fully aware of how difficult the conservation work will be for her organization and for the Chinese people, but she has no thoughts of giving up on the struggle ahead.
I think for environmental activists, we have to be optimistic and we have to be more proactive. If we lose our confidence, how can we influence other people? On the other hand, we have to realize that this is definitely not an easy process, or we would say it's a long march to go. We have to hurry up. Yeah.
That's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact. These profiles of international changemakers were co-produced with Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. You can learn more about the work of these courageous women at radioproject.org. If you'd like to order a CD of this program, our toll-free number is 800-529-5736. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Additional audio courtesy of Dar Williams and Takako Nishizaki and the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra. Stephanie Welch is our production engineer. Lisa Rudman, executive director. Peggy Law, founding director. Senior producer Tina Rubio. Intern Elena Botkin-Levy. Volunteers Ron Rucker and Dan Turner. And I'm your host, Sandina Robbins.